It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So you're toying with taking on cooking, but where to begin? Well, the standard answer, and a sound one, is learn to control heat, the different techniques for simmering, sautéing, roasting. But when it comes to creating fantastic tastes, get thee to a good Indian cookbook. Today, Raghavan Iyer, a master Indian chef and teacher, will reveal all.
To me, the beauty of Indian food is creating that complexity with really not a bajillion spices, but maybe just one or two spices treated in such a way that you're going to end up with a complexity that just blows your mind.
Wow.
The tricks you're going to learn will echo through your food for the rest of your life. And Michael Pollan's here, too, with some new brilliance.
Using fast food, that was the progressive thing to do. That kind of campaign, I think, really undermined home cooking. There's no money to be made in farming or selling simple food. All the money is in processing it.
Stay with us for lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Ed Lee was a Korean-American kid growing up in Brooklyn. Now he's the celebrated chef at 610 Magnolia in Louisville, Kentucky. Famous for surprising recipes like chicken-fried pork chops with ramen crust and slow-cooked collards with kimchi. Well, they're all part of his new book, Smoke and Pickles, along with the unlikely story of how a Korean Brooklynite can become a Southerner. Food writer Francis Lam is an editor at Clarkson Potter. He's a Chinese-American who, like Ed, grew up with immigrant parents. Ed talked to Francis from his restaurant in Louisville, 610 Magnolia.
Hi, Ed. It's great to have you.
It's great to be on Splendid Table. Thank you.
I want to start with one of the first stories I actually read in the book, and it really struck me. And it was a story you tell of your sister taking you out, and you were like sneaking around and got lamb gyros for lunch. And how you weren't supposed to do that. On some level, it was about like, you know, lamb wasn't like kind of a cool food in your family, but really it was because your mom didn't want you to go out there. And doing stuff you're not supposed to be doing seems to be a theme in the book and maybe even a theme in your life. Like if your parents are anything like mine, you know, they probably wanted you to grow up to be a doctor or a lawyer, you know, like so many immigrant parents want of their children. So can you tell me what it was like when you decided, you know, I want to be a cook?
It was a very awkward day for me and my parents. And it was funny because at the time, too, I was going to NYU and I was a lit major. And I told my lit advisor, who was grooming me to go to grad school for literature, and I told him that I was going to chuck it all and become a cook. And, I mean, the look on his face, the look on my parents, I mean, there was a lot of disappointment all around me. And I guess with any new sort of immigration wave, there's always that push and pull between, you know, the values of the old country and then obviously the fascination and the exposure that you have to all the different cultures in, you know, what we call America. And I don't know what it was, but I knew from very early on that I was fascinated by culture. I was fascinated by falafels. You know, I was fascinated by Indian food. And we had Jamaican neighbors, and I used to love the smells that came from their kitchen. And it was so foreign from the smells that came from my kitchen.
Mm.
But I loved that.
But then so you're inspired by all these different smells and like all your Indian neighbors and your Jamaican neighbors. And, you know, at some point you have this hot, sexy, celebrity-studded restaurant called Clay, downtown Manhattan. But then, boom, you move to Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're a chef in Louisville. And I imagine you didn't have that many southern neighbors, so you probably didn't smell collard greens so much growing up. So when you got to Louisville, what were the foods and smells that inspired you there? What ingredients or what traditions like drew you in?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I moved to Louisville, say, about 9-10 years ago. And I started to discover sort of indigenous ingredients, things like country ham, you know, things like sorghum. I'd never had sorghum until I moved down to Kentucky. I didn't know what sorghum was.
Can you tell us what sorghum is?
So sorghum is actually a plant. It's very similar to a sugar cane. It's been grown here for generations, actually. And much like sugar cane, you sort of cut it down when they're ripe, and then you put it through rollers, and you kind of press out the juice, and then you boil it very slowly over a number of hours at a very low temperature, and different sorghum producers will boil it to different grades of brownness. So you can kind of get a light amber sorghum or a really dark sorghum that is closer to molasses. And once I tasted it, once I tasted all the different variations of it, I was immediately hooked. Mm. The day I discovered sorghum, we basically stopped buying honey. We take sort of country hams or city hams, and we glaze the hams with sorghum. The most obvious application would be dessert. So we take cooked grits, and we churn it into a sorghum-based cream ice cream, which is a really popular dish.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, I didn't come to the South intending to be a Southern chef. You know, I didn't come here saying, well, I'm going to put on a pair of dungarees and you know, chew on some cornbread. But I think as a natural extension, if you're curious, you can't help but be fascinated by these things that are happening around you and these traditions that, you know, I walked into.
Yeah, right on. So, I mean, you're so seduced by the traditions of the South that are all around you, but you wrote something really interesting in the book, too, which is that being in the South, you also kind of rediscovered your own Koreanness and your own Korean traditions that you came from. Can you tell me about what you meant by that or how that happened?
Yeah, you know, I guess growing up in a big city, you don't realize your ethnicity because everyone's ethnic. You know, there is no ethnic because everyone is different, and sort of being different is what brings everyone together. You know, I grew up knowing I was Korean, but I never grew up thinking I was other or different. It was just sort of, you know, to say the cliche, it was a big melting pot. And then you move to the South, and it's hard not to immediately recognize every time you walk out your door that, you know, everyone looks the same except you. It you know, there is a homogeneous culture here that is just different from the big city.
Mm-hmm. And you also said something interesting, though, which is being an outsider and how being an outsider, you can cook the Southern food in a different way, and they'll let you do it in a different way.
Yeah, you know, it's so, again, your advantage and your disadvantage. I can get into some very heated arguments about cornbread recipes because this is the way we've been doing it for generations. And you just don't stray from that, mm-hmm. not when it's part of your family recipe. You know, then in comes me, you know, and I've got all these ideas about how to make things differently. What I don't have is the baggage of 200 years of tradition on my shoulders. So they kind of look at me and say, hey, there's that funny Asian kid putting soy sauce and everything again. And you know, I'm allowed to do that. I'm allowed to make mistakes. I'm allowed to venture beyond the traditional sort of canon of Southern recipes.
Right. Doing stuff you're not supposed to do, once again. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Francis. This was fun.
Chef Ed Lee is author of Smoke and Pickles. Food writer Francis Lamb is an editor at Clarkson Potter. Now, you can find Ed's recipe for rice bowl with beef, onions, collards, fried egg, and corn chili remoulade, all of that, at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our newest project. It's a quarterly ebook, Eating In with Lynn. It's my quarterly diary of sorts of what's going on in my kitchen on weekends. You're going to find new weekend menus designed to morph into weeknight dishes. Of course, there's going to also be lots of extras, from cooking lessons, shortcuts, how to improv, to my latest finds and opinions. Head to the website, splendidtable.org. Sometime, watch a toddler eat and boy, will you appreciate the spoon. Who came up with this brilliant idea? I mean, it can do everything. You can even cut with its side. Well, welcome to the realm of things we rarely think about. This is where food history takes center stage. The everyday, the ordinary, the taken for granted usually have anything but ordinary stories behind them. British food historian B. Wilson loves this sort of research. Among other awards, she was named Food Writer of the Year by the BBC. Well, Bee's latest book is Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. Bee, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, you cover all of the things that are in the kitchen and on the table in this book. You've got egg beaters, you've got pots and pans, you've got kitchen design. But one of the things that intrigued me was the spoon. You say the spoon is the mirror of a culture. That's a pretty big statement.
It is a pretty big statement, but I think the thing about spoons is that they belong to every human culture in the world. There are fork cultures, there are chopstick cultures, but everyone uses spoons, and they go way, way back to the first ancient ancestors using shells lashed onto sticks. And therefore, I think they're a very good mirror to the surrounding culture to look at the particular form that the spoon takes and what that tells us about the kind of foods that a particular culture likes to eat.
So, for instance,
if you look at Victorian times, the 19th century, whether in Britain or in the States, there's this mad profusion of spoons, everything from citrus spoons to gravy ladles to tomato spoons, sauce spoons. And there are many different reasons for this. You could say it's a product of the Industrial Revolution and spoons could be mass produced as never before. You could also say it's part of the development from service à la française, where all the dishes were laid on the table at one time, to service à la russe, where there was, you know, the succession of courses that we would still expect to this day in fancy restaurants.
I think that that's such an interesting thing that a lot of us don't realize, that in the 19th century, people started serving a meal in a completely different way.
They did. They started eating courses for the first time. This notion of there being starters and main courses and desserts didn't exist before. Everything would have been laid out all together. And you needed far fewer individual items of flatware or cutlery. So that's one thing. But I think the big thing that happened in the 19th century was a new civilization of table manners, a new anxiety at the table about touching food, handling food. And these specialised spoons go along with that because it's a way of never feeling that you have to get too close to food with all of its stickiness and noise. It's a way of being extremely polite. And there were even special solid silver potato chip servers marketed by Tiffany's, which I think is a very rarefied item. I'm not sure many households have those today.
So you're saying people were anxious, they wanted to distance themselves? What had happened that brought that about?
I think it's part of a whole kind of culture of manners. And if you look at the sort of rules that come out about handling food in 19th century etiquette books, there'll be things like soup must always be drunk from the edge of the soup spoon. So you're not sort of getting too close to the soup, except for men with moustaches. They were allowed to drink the soup from the end of the spoon. Or things like elaborate rules about things being eaten with forks, how to eat a peach with a fork, how to eat corn on the cob with a fork, which no sense at all. But it seems to go along with a kind of general sense that you don't want to pick things up and eat them with your fingers. You don't want to get sticky. You want to remain dignified and graceful. And the flatware goes along with that. But as the food writer Dara Goldstein has said, it also creates a kind of nervousness. She's described this condition of fork anxiety. The sense being that once you've got these tools like tomato spoons available, you really feel that you ought to be using them and just an ordinary spoon won't do anymore.
You talk about a period too of the political spoon.
Yes. In 1660 in Britain, Charles II came back to the throne during the period known as the Restoration. And there had been a brief 11-year period known as the Commonwealth when we'd had no king at all, having executed our king in 1649. And it was crucial for Charles II to really impose his will and make everyone forget the fact that we'd done without a king. And one of the ways he did that was through spoons. He'd been at the court in France, where they had a particular type of spoon called the trefid. No one in Britain had ever eaten with one of these spoons before 1660. And almost overnight, this became the dominant shape. If people had one of the older spoons, the Puritans, they disliked ornamentation in any form. And Puritan spoons were very plain, solid pieces of silver with an egg-shaped bowl and a very plain, flat handle. And if you had a Puritan spoon after the Restoration, you would be pretty sure to take it to a silversmith and get it melted down and remade as a trefid. And the trefid is really the spoon which lends its shape to all subsequent modern spoons, in that the bowl for the first time becomes the deep oval that we all recognise as a spoon shape. But the distinctive thing about it was that the handle finished in this three-cleft shape, hence the name. We sometimes imagine that all changes in cutlery would be something very gradual. They'd happen over many generations. This happened straight away. In 1660, no one had eaten with one of these spoons before. By 1680, the trefid had spread through the whole of Britain, and it would be very rare to come across a Puritan spoon at all.
Completely different way of looking at this thing we use every day. Thanks so much, Bea.
Thank you.
British food historian Bea Wilson's book is Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. Now, if you want to put a spoon into something that's a one-of-a-kind, outrageously good dessert, I've got a recipe for you. It's the creation of the late Sam Arnold, the Southwestern food historian and chili maven. It's his sweet avocado green chili ice cream, and you can find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, our latest Key 3 chef, Raghavan Iyer, and Michael Pollan on the Zen of the Kitchen. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Indian cook and best-selling author Raghavan Iyer is in the kitchen with us today for another round of our series, Key 3, where good cooks are asked to pick their three essential recipes, the ones that they believe every cook and wannabe cook should know. Well, Raghavan's genius is not only what he can do at a stove, but how he takes the complicated cuisines of India and makes sense out of them. Raised in Mumbai, he's back in India every year, exploring every step of the way. But we got to meet him at Cooks of Crocus Hill in St. Paul, Minnesota. Their cooking school is one of those ideal kitchens with good stoves and wide counters. And Raghavan had arranged on those counters antique painted spice boxes from India, and then surrounded them with bowls of bright yellow peas, ruby chilies, green and red cabbage, and a brilliant orange pot on the stove. And Raghavan himself was in a vivid purple chef's coat. Raghavan, I'm so glad we can do this. Thanks for doing Key 3. Oh,
it's my pleasure. I love being with you, Lynn.
So what are your Key 3 dishes?
One is a dal, which is a legume-based curry.
Uh-huh.
We're doing a spiced rice. And we're doing a cabbage slaw.
Which one do you want to begin with?
We'll start with dal. And the kind of dal we're doing today is done with yellow split peas. The variety of yellow split peas in India is slightly different, but it looks very similar to the variety that you find here. And we call it chana dal in India, which is actually black garbanzo beans that have been split and the skins have been removed.
And these are the size of tiny peas, but they're really a beautiful yellow color.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm looking at everything you have laid out here, and the colors are vibrant. And one of the things I think that's so appealing about this cuisine is not only that there are endless varieties of taste, but it's beautiful to look at.
You've hit the nail on the head. With Indian food, to me, it's all about colors, its textures, its aromas, its temperatures. And so you eat with all your senses. But I've had people say, oh, Indian food, you know, it's all yellow, it's all the same.
It's all curry powder.
Yeah, and, you know, first of all, curry powder ain't Indian food.
Right.
And second of all, you know, to me, the beauty of Indian food is creating that complexity with really not a bajillion spices, but maybe just one or two spices treated in such a way that you're going to end up with a complexity that just blows your mind.
Wow. Let's get to making dal.
We'll get to making dal. So what I've done so far is I have washed the peas, and then I will go ahead and start. I'm just adding water to it. No broth. And oftentimes people say, well, why are you doing that without broth? Because if you think about it, the diva in Indian cooking really are the spices. And so cluttering it with things like broth and so on, you really don't need that because the spices really shine.
Okay.
And that's what I want to prove in this dish is, first of all, the simplicity of it, 10 ingredients or less.
Uh-huh.
And it is about going to the main grocery stores and just getting what it is that we're familiar with, potatoes, onions, chilies, cilantro, and so on. And so you look at one spice in point, which is ground turmeric.
And it's that gorgeous, gorgeous yellow color.
You know, students in the past, they'll go, ooh, curry. I said, ooh, not. I said, this is ground turmeric that gives commercial curry powders that notorious yellow color.
Is it true that curry powder originated when the British came back to England?
400 years ago, when the English were in India, they fell in love with some of the sauces in the southeast and the northwest, and they had their cooks put together a cornucopia of ingredients that they ground and put them in a jar and labeled it as curry powder. But as a concept, you do not have curry powders in India. To us, in a nutshell, if it doesn't have a sauce, it's not a curry. And not all curries have turmeric in it either. And so, in essence, a dal to us is a legume curry. is why
okay.
Boils
because
down
it's saucy.
Because it's saucy.
Okay.
Just like you and me.
Okay, so we've got about a half a teaspoon, and we're not really
turmeric.
Measuring.
No, and so in this dish, you know, we've got the turmeric in here, and that actually will continue to cook and add color and flavor to
right.
the peas. It'll come to a boil, and then we're going to get some of the foam that sort of separates naturally as part of the cooking process.
Okay.
So once we get some of that foam out, this is where we're now going
to... Why are you doing that?
Because it creates a sauce that is a little bit clearer.
Okay.
Plus, you know, I mean, one of the school of thoughts is that, you know, it helps you digest it much better, which is, you know, when talking to some of the food scientists, that certainly could be debatable. Now, we're going to go ahead and add some potatoes.
And they're diced about half
an inch.
Half inch little cubes.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so we're going to now just let that continue to simmer, and we're going to do that covered, and that will cook the potatoes. But while that is doing its thing,
right.
we're going to now look at building the flavors in this pot. And into this dish, all we're going to do is add three spices, and one is cumin seed. I always say buy spices as much as possible in the entire seed form. Because you give whole spices to a good Indian cook,
mm-hmm.
he or she should be able to extract 8 flavors from a given spice, depending on what you do with it. So when it's used raw, as is in the seed form, you get one flavor. If it's ground raw, you get a second flavor. If it's dry toasted, which is what we're going to do, left in the seed form, flavor number 3. If it's ground after it has been dry toasted, flavor number 4. If it's sauteed in some kind of a fat, left in the seed form, you get flavor number 5. If it's ground after it has been sauteed, flavor number 6. If it's soaked in some kind of a liquid used in the seed form, flavor number 7. If it's ground after it has been soaked in the liquid, flavor number 8.
Okay.
And you think about that. You change the liquid, you change the flavor of the spice also. We're also going to this, we're going to add some coriander seeds. You need about a tablespoon.
They always have an orangey overtone, or is it my imagination?
It's actually a distant member of the citrus family, and so when you grind it intensifies its citrus quality.
Okay, so you've chosen these 2 spices, the coriander and the cumin. What's next?
We're adding some chilies to this, and these are whole chilies.
Oh, well, these are small, dried red chilies. And if I remember, the smaller the chili, the hotter the chili.
Yes. And we're going to go ahead and toast these. My pan is now preheating. And so
okay, so a little fry pan.
You notice that there's no oil.
Yeah, that's right.
And so to this, we're going to add the whole spices. And when you're toasting spices, you're looking for the first color change, and you're looking for the first aroma change. You can hear that sizzle that is happening without the oil.
Oh, yes. And you have this over a medium.
Medium high,
yeah.
I would say. But you can see what's happened very
and they're
quickly.
Darkening.
They're darkening.
Darkening, yeah.
They have changed. This is all we're looking for right now.
That fast?
That fast. You can see the chilies have blackened.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're going to take this, and we're going to add it right to a blender jar.
Okay.
And then to create a liquid base for that, we're going to add some tomatoes to it. And then we will puree all of that together.
You're really bringing it down to a very, yeah, there's tiny bits in there, but basically it's a puree.
But
oh my goodness. Oh, and the aroma, oh my. You can smell that lusciousness of the tomato.
There's a smokiness that comes
through. Oh gosh, yeah.
And so this is what's going to flavor our legume curry.
So this goes into?
Right into the pot. Once the potatoes are done, we are now adding this.
This is really beautiful because you have the bright yellow split peas, you've got the russet color of the tomato and the ground spice, and then you have flecks of fresh coriander. Mm. It's a gorgeous dish.
It is a gorgeous dish.
Can I taste it?
Yes, of course.
Okay, now this is beautiful. This is a stew-like consistency.
And this is what blankets rice.
Oh, my. Oh.
You're tasting the complexity that's coming through.
Oh, and I can get the spices. But you're right, they're all blended.
Mm-hmm. It's a marriage that really works very well with this dish.
Raghavan, this is just delicious. Thanks so much for doing Key 3 with us.
Anytime.
Raghavan Iyer is the author of 660 Curries and the forthcoming Indian Cooking Unfolded. Now, you can hear the rest of our Key 3 discussion, see the pictures we snapped as we recorded, and get the recipes for his three essential dishes, the smoky yellow split peas, the sweet-scented pilaf, and Indian slaw. Everything's at splendidtable.org. Michael Pollan of the Omnivore's Dilemma fame, the man who challenges us to rethink how we eat, well, he's taken on a surprising project. He set out to learn to cook. His new book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. After all his forays into the hows and the whys of our food systems, it dawned on him he really didn't cook. He more or less assembled with good food, but he believes that isn't what cooking is really about. Michael, it has been far too long. It's good to have you back.
Thank you. It's very good to be back.
So, Michael, one of the things you bring up in the book is that cooking does not have the same respectability, the same regard as literature does, or the arts, or the sciences. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's a good question. You know, at other times it has been held in higher regard. I think it's been denigrated in our own time for a couple of reasons. One is that it has been women's work for a very long time. At least home cooking has. And the arbiters of prestige are very often men in this culture. So they didn't completely appreciate the wonders of cooking and the complexity of it. But another reason, I think, is that what I think of as the agro-industrial food system has deliberately denigrated cooking because corporations very much wanted to take over this work. And so you see this concerted campaign that goes, you know, back 75 years, but really intensifies after World War II, with the food industry trying to persuade you that this is not a legitimate use of your time and that they would be very happy to do it for you and relieve you of the burden, long before anybody thought about cooking as a burden.
Yeah, but it's really interesting because I think, was it Laura Shapiro who did a book about that era?
Terrific book, yeah.
Yeah, it was Something from the Oven, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't she mention that in those days when women who worked at home, and many women did, the one thing they really enjoyed was cooking.
Exactly. There was an effort to kind of lump all housework together, but women said they liked cooking. Cooking was a creative outlet. But I think what happened, too, as women got busier and more women went into the workplace, something had to give. And we were at this very interesting, you know, kind of post-Betty Friedan moment where there was a very uncomfortable conversation unfolding. Women were going back to work. Women's liberation was very much in the air. And there was tension over who would do the housework. It had to be renegotiated. And before that conversation could be completely played out and resolved, the food industry very self-consciously stepped in and said, "We'll take care of it. We've got you covered." And they came forward with fast food and processed food. And it was a very deliberate effort on their part, in fact, to hitch their agenda to that of feminism. And there is a wonderful billboard that I can remember from the 70s. Kentucky Fried Chicken had this billboard all over the country, giant bucket of fried chicken with just two words above it, women's liberation. So that if you went down the path of using fast food, that was the progressive thing to do. So, you know, it's that kind of campaign, I think, that really undermined home cooking. And it did it for, you know, very good capitalist reasons. I mean, I've written about food for a long time, as you know, and I've gone back to the farm and forward to the, you know, food processors. There's no money to be made in farming or selling simple food. All the money is in processing it. And it's no wonder now that, you know, of your food dollar, something like 92% of it does not go to the farmer. It goes to processors and packagers and shippers and advertisers and marketers. So the way you make money is shrinking the amount that we spend on actual farm goods and getting us to let corporations cook for us.
You know, one very striking thing you wrote was about the senses that cooking appeals to. Can you explain?
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things about Western culture is over time it has tended to devalue the physical senses and to elevate the eye and the ear to some extent. But the sense of taste, smell, and touch have been considered in the whole tradition of Western philosophy and literature to be lower and more feminine, by the way. It's definitely tied to a misogynistic streak. And cooking trafficked in those lower senses. It was stuff you could taste and smell, and that was more basic. The other problem with cooking in Western culture, of course, is Puritanism. We look down on those activities that both animals and us like to do. And eating is one, and sex, of course, is another. And so Puritanism had trouble with both those things because they were base and physical. And I think
but the
that
most fun.
Yes, I know. Well, fun is a problem if you're a Puritan.
I guess it is, isn't it?
So, you know, so much of our culture is has been about this kind of sublimation of those senses. And cooking appeals very frankly to it, although we sometimes pretend otherwise. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book is this wonderful euphemistic vocabulary around cheese. Now, cheese, you know, appeals to some of the basest sensory desires. It smells like human bodies. And I finally found a cheesemaker who was willing to kind of admit that, yeah, this is part of what, you know, a good stinky cheese is about. And Freud has written about the fact that we basically wanted to elevate ourselves above the animals. You know, when we stood up, we were no longer on all fours sniffing the rear ends of things all over the world. We were standing up and we privileged the eye and the ear at that point.
You talk about some of the imperatives of why to cook. And we know about the family around the dinner table, and I don't mean to shove that aside and say it's not important, but some of the other things you talk about really got to me.
Well, I think there are a lot of very good reasons to cook, well beyond the fact that it's really good for your health and your family's kind of psychological well-being, and it's very good for your social life to sit down with other people. And I mean, all this is kind of obvious. But I found that there were some other virtues. I think of cooking as a political act. I mean, I think we've kind of fallen into this place where we are so dependent on others to do everything for us, and that all we do is we take the one thing we do for a living, we sell that into the market, and we take that money and use that to outsource everything in our lives. And that leads to a kind of dependence that's almost infantilizing. There is something very satisfying in providing for yourself, even to some extent. And I would include gardening in that, too.
Right. Yeah.
You feel so much more competent, self-reliant, independent when you know, hey, I could make a loaf of bread if I wanted to, if I needed to. So that's one thing that to me is very important. The other is our senses these days. We spend our lives in front of screens and, you know, we have five senses, not just two, not just the eye and the ear. And cooking reemploys your senses. And I think one of the reasons that some people are rediscovering cooking now is the fact that it is enormously satisfying to once again use your hands, to once again use your sense of smell and taste. And cooking is one of those rare activities that engages all five senses.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Michael Pollan is author of Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Michael uses a pasta sauce to illustrate the art of the braise. So find his recipe, meat, sugo, and pasta, on the website, splendidtable.org. You stay with us. We're going to be back in a moment to talk with you and to check in with the actor who is taking on the food deserts of New Orleans. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to connect with you. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Jess is on the line from Minneapolis. So, Jess, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I listen to the show whenever I'm cooking, and you frequently mention using Parmesan rinds to flavor soups.
Yes, yes. And stews, too.
So I'm confused. I've tried this, and it's, you know, I end up with just this Parmesan wad at the bottom of my stock pot.
Right.
And so I want to, you know, be economical and get the most out of the flavor of the Parmesan rind. So I'm just wondering, how exactly do you do this?
Well, what you do is you get a gloppy, end up getting this gloppy lump of Parmigiano on the bottom of the pot. You lift it out. Now,
These days, people throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
In the golden olden days, you know, when people didn't have used everything, they would wash this off, sit it out on a rack or whatever to dry. It won't dry completely,
mm-hmm.
but essentially they would use it again and again. Now, I've actually stuck it in the freezer.
Okay, so it will kind of dissolve into each stew that you use?
It doesn't really dissolve. Mm-hmm. You're using the imported true Parmigiano, right?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know how it gets soft and kind of mushy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's normal. That's normal. And it gives out, you know, Parmesan has a ton of umami in it,
mm-hmm.
which is that substance that lifts the flavors of everything it comes in contact with. So the interesting thing is you not only get a hint of the flavor of the cheese, but it tends to magnify the flavors of everything else. And our grandparents or great-grandparents didn't know that. They just knew they didn't want to waste it, and it made things taste better. And when you didn't have a lot of meat or that kind of thing, you threw it in some water with some vegetables, and you got a better-tasting soup or stew. So, but I would say reuse it. Do you notice a difference?
I don't know if the pieces, if the rind pieces I'm using are large enough to really make a difference.
What are you using?
They're probably the size of like a wheat thin cracker. Is that too small? I need to go huge?
You need to go big. And, you know, it's go big or go home kind
of
thing. Yeah,
but then reusing it, you know.
But wait a minute. You get together enough of those wheat thin pieces and you're going to have enough.
Oh, yeah.
But if you can, you know, I know this is an investment, but get a wedge of Parmigiano, which mm-hmm. will be a great treat anyway. And, you know, it can last a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then just take all of that rind. I would use a piece about, generally speaking, a piece probably about 3 or 4 inches by 3 or 4 inches.
Okay.
Yeah. And remember, you can not only store them in the fridge, wrap them up airtight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They do tend to get a little mold on them. Just scrape it off. It's not a big deal.
Okay.
But you can also throw the rinds in the freezer. So there you go.
Wonderful. I learned so much from your show. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. This is not me. This is my grandmother. I mean, I just learned it all from her.
Hey, wonderful.
You enjoy those little wheat thins. They're going to work too.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252. Jacob is calling from Cocoa, Florida.
Hi, Lynn. First, thanks for taking my call. I'm a huge fan of the show, so I really appreciate it. And so basically, this is what happened. I endeavored to create my own grenadine recently.
Yeah.
And I'm one of these shoppers that never writes anything down, so I mistakenly picked up a bottle of rose water instead of the orange blossom water that the recipe asked for. And so I took this stuff home and realized that I had the wrong ingredient.
Right.
But it was relatively expensive. It's a nice bottle, but I'd like to use it. But what I'm interested in, because I know that typically people use rose water in baked goods, I was wondering if there's a savory dish that perhaps the rose water would work well
in. I can't think of one offhand, because it has such a distinctive aroma. But the other side of it is, I wonder how rose water would be in something like a Middle Eastern flatbread. Because it was used a very long time ago during the Renaissance, believe it or not, to flavor pasta. And I've made it. I'm not saying it's the best flavor in the world, but I'm thinking, I mean, you could make handmade pasta, but if you make it just a simple bread dough that you roll out, you know, quite thin, but you put a bit of rose water in it, not too much, a bit,
mm-hmm.
and let that bake. And then what I think would be interesting is to, halfway through the baking, brush it with olive oil and put some sesame seeds on top of it.
That
combination may really work. The other thing you can do with it, it's a tradition I had in Moroccan restaurants where with meals you're going to eat with your hands, right?
Okay.
And I mean, this could be ribs or hot dogs. It'd be really fun. What you do is you dampen washcloths or small towels with water that's been scented with rose water. So it's a really nice, delicate scent. You put them in the microwave so they're hot. And then you put them in a basket. And before everybody gets to dig in, okay, you take tongs and you hand them these warm towels and they can wash their hands before and after the meal. And that scent of rose water is just wonderful. That's two things I can think of. Now, I would say check some Middle Eastern sources too, because that's where it's used a great deal, and North Africa.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. Take
care.
You too. Mark is on the phone from Venice Beach, California. What would you like to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I work at a really wonderful upscale grocery store, and the marketing department calls me like a cedar plant guru. I mean, I smoke all of our, I smoke our fish, I do our Gravlax, I do all kinds of great stuff. And I really want your treasure trove of information if you can help me. I do, I'm doing cedar planking classes on how to deal with seafood.
Right.
And so I really, some fish really diffuse that cedar more than others. So if you have any, I do it at home, but with charcoal. Here at work, I do it with gas. So,
so you know, the fish is on the plank, and then and you are
on
putting
the, on the plank, you know,
and
for
the
like
plank
salmon.
Is, yeah, okay, and then you're taking that into the oven or the grill.
Well, yeah, I just put it. I put the fish directly on the cedar.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll put herbs in between. Let's say for salmon,
mm-hmm.
or you know, or if there's skin on it, I'll put herbs and such between in between the plank and the skin.
Right.
And then give it a go, and you know, and just
now,
watch
where
it.
Do
so,
you put? The, how do you actually do the cooking? Just so everybody, so we're all on the same page.
Oh yes, well, you know, a hot grill, just a super fairly hot grill, and you know, I put the wood with the fish on it directly on the grill, and it's a one-time thing because you know, by the time it's done, depending on how thick the fish is and such, you know, that is. I've got embers on the corners of the cedar.
Yes, exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
And so, I don't know, if you have any suggestions about how, because certain fish that are medium, moist fish, they will really pull in, like
yes.
when I smoke fish as well, that cedar. But other fish, maybe it's just the fat content, I don't know.
You've nailed it. You just
is
nailed it.
Is that what it is?
It's the fat, I think it's the fat content, because what happens is fat absorbs flavor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it carries flavor, but it also absorbs flavor. You know how if you make a stew and you have, you know, spices in it, whatever, and you get a film of fat on top, and
yep.
if you get to taste that fat, it's just packed with everything you put into that stew. The same thing in terms of fish. So fattier fish, this is why salmon, you know, is one of the prime things to smoke, because it has such a high fat content. If you do super lean fish, I think it's kind of a waste of time, because you're not going to get that pulling in of all those flavors and, you know, pulling in of all that delicious cedar quality.
Wow.
So I'd say stick with fattier fish, and
okay.
you should have the problem solved. And the method you're using is obviously it's classic, but I love the idea of putting the herbs between the wood and the fish, because that's – and you could probably use two, you know, little slivers of fruit or the rind of citrus or whatever mixed
Ooh.
Up in there. That would be Ooh. Lovely. Or garlic. You know, it's fair game.
Excellent.
The point is you know exactly what you're doing. I think it's just a case of fat carries flavor, so go for the fattier fish.
Yes, I will.
Well,
Lynn, thank you.
Well, you have my mouth watering.
Me too.
Mark, this sounds great. Thank you.
You too. Have a good day.
You too. You know, this idea, you can buy cedar planks now. I mean, a lot of specialty stores, you know, kitchen stores are selling them. And grilling season, meat does beautifully with cedar. Some vegetables, sweet potatoes on cedar, not a bad thing. Call us, 800-537-5252. Send us an email, go to splendidtable.org. And, of course, there's Twitter and there's Facebook. Food desert. That is the low-income neighborhoods where there's no place to buy healthy food. That term is now part of our everyday vocabulary in supposedly the wealthiest nation in the world. Well, people are working to erase food deserts from the language. And one of them is actor Wendell Pierce, late of The Wire, now in Tremé, the HBO series about post-Katrina New Orleans. Pierce is a NOLA native and now a grocer. That's right, a grocer. His stores are called Sterling Farms. Wendell, it's good to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Lynn.
You know, I'm thinking about, okay, actors do restaurants and they do clubs, but right. actors don't do grocery store chains.
They do now.
How did you come to this?
Well, you know, I'm from New Orleans, born and raised. And, you know, when Katrina happened, my neighborhood was in some of the deepest part of the flooding, Pontchartrain Park. And it was a neighborhood that was like Mayberry. You know, our parents fought long and hard during the ugly time segregated New Orleans, and it was one place, separate but equal, but that African Americans in the 50s could purchase, you know, homes.
Right.
And it turned out to be an incubator of talent. It was great. It's a golf course, multi-denominational churches, Southern University at New Orleans. You know, it was just idyllic, but it was destroyed. And basically put out a call to action to everybody of my generation saying, we owe it to our parents to go back and rebuild. And we did that. We started it, and we're in the middle of it now. We created our own development corporation. But then I looked around and I said, man, the commercial districts aren't coming back. And as I did more research, I started to realize that, you know, New Orleans was populated with food deserts and underserved communities where people didn't have access to just fresh produce and fresh foods. And when I saw that, I talked to my partners and I said, let's start a grocery store. Let's start a grocery store chain. And that's how Sterling Farms, which is the name of my grocery store, was born.
Now, you've just opened one, right?
Yes.
A short time ago.
It is the flagship. We opened about 3 weeks ago, and it's been wonderful. The response in the community of people saying, oh, you know, I was waiting for something to come to the neighborhood. And it's just been wonderful, and it kind of validated what I knew was there, pent-up demand. You know, we hop in the car and go to the grocery store all the time. And for a lot of people, that's hopping on a bus or having to walk or having to go a little further because they don't have one in their neighborhood. And that shouldn't happen in America. So we see those neighborhoods as emerging markets instead of depressed areas. And it's proving to be true.
Well, you once said that there were 16,000 customers for every grocery store in New Orleans on average.
Yes.
Does that guarantee that Sterling Farms is going to be able to be viable?
Well, you know, there's no guarantees when you're trying to build a business. But, you know, we have access to about 25,000 homes that we know on average 2.5 people. You know, I can get into all the data.
Right, right.
You know, but that's a large portion of people. That's a lot of people that we have access to and that we're willing to compete for their business. We know we have to earn their trust. We have to earn their interests. We have to make our store their neighborhood, you know, grocery destination. And, you know, the one thing I always remembered was shopping for groceries, as we say in New Orleans, we say making groceries, with my mother on a Friday night. And it was a ritual and to go there, and it was this store called Schwegman's, and it was, you know, it was like a wonderland for a kid. You know, I want this, I want that. Oh, let's get that. And you're seeing the men and women, you know, getting off work, and they had a little bar and restaurant in this place, and, you know, knowing the fishmonger and knowing the butchers and having our favorite cashier. And it was a town square. It's the equivalent of a town square. And that neighborhood grocery is something we take for granted and don't realize it until you lose it.
Yeah.
And until, you know, your culture is challenged the way New Orleans was challenged 7 years ago. And it's great to see the faces of people coming back. I literally had a woman cry. I mean, what businessman can say, I had a woman come into my store and say, can I speak to you? And she walked outside because she didn't want to be seen.
Uh-huh.
And she welled up with emotion. Thank you so much. And that meant everything to me, you know, because
yeah.
People in what are considered underserved communities have shown their loyalty to brand and store and product to American industry by making an effort to get to their store, to get to their brand. It takes a little effort on their part to go there, and all they ask is that we as American industry come to their communities, and we've stood on the sidelines saying, that's a little too much risk.
Mm-hmm.
So where other companies see risk, I see reward. But the greatest opportunity is not only to do well, but to do good. The two can coexist.
Wendell, thanks for talking with us. This is
Thank
an
you
exciting
very much.
Project. Wendell Pierce and his partners recently opened their first Sterling Farms grocery in the Marais area of New Orleans. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Chef Alain Ducasse, who said, desserts are like mistresses. They're bad for you. If you're having one, well, you might as well have two. Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Now head to our website to get information on anything you heard here today. Browse through our recipes, visit our online store, get registered for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and take a look at our new quarterly e-book. It's called Eating In with Lynn, Weekend Menus and Worknight Encores. You know where it is, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.